Good morning. Did you think I got my slides mixed up this morning? This is usually not the Sunday morning that we bring a lesson from our 2020 congregational theme, but the elders thought it would be good to reinforce this theme a little more in the closing months of this year. And it's always a good time to delve into this inexhaustible subject of understanding God's will more and more clearly. And for me, it's difficult to think of an area where that is more needed than in the area of the family. Turn with me to Psalm 128. Psalm 128. We're going to use the first four verses of this passage as a springboard for our study this morning. Psalm 128, beginning in verse 1, says, "How blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. When you shall eat of the fruit of your hands, you will be happy, and it will be well with you. Your wife shall be like a fruitful vine within your house, your children like olive plants around your table. Behold, for thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord." Now, that's an idyllic scene, isn't it? I mean, a happy family, blessed by God, who love Him and love one another. It's hard to picture a scene more happy and cozy and full of godliness and mutual love than the one that this psalm paints for us. But you know, that's not the picture in every household, is it? That's not the way it is for every family. We see in our society the breakdown of that family more and more. Last week I had shared with you some statistics I had gotten from the Bureau of Justice website. Here's some more statistics for those who like that kind of stuff. 80% of all violent crime, think about this statistic for a moment, 80% of violent crime is committed by people 18 years and younger without a father figure in the home. That's a mind-boggling statistic. Here's another one for you. Nearly 70% of people polled said, "Any way but spending time with the family is an ideal way to spend an evening. Anyway, anything but being with the family, I'd rather do that than be with them for an evening." What's wrong with our families? What's wrong with that unit that God Himself has created? What's going on with America's, with the world's families? There's a woman named Ellen Defoe Whitehead, who writes extensively on issues concerning marriage and the family. And she wrote this some time ago. She said, "If current trends continue, less than half of our children born today will live continuously with their father or mother throughout childhood. Children from disrupted families have a harder time achieving intimacy in a relationship, forming a stable marriage, or even holding a steady job. Contrary to popular belief, many children do not bounce back after a divorce and remarriage. Difficulties associated with a family breakup persist 20, 30, even 40 years into adulthood." You know when she wrote that? She wrote that in 1993. Nearly 30 years ago. And she says that if things persist as they are now 30 years ago, we're going to find that nearly 50% of kids are growing up without a mother and a father figure, both in the house. And of course, we see that her prophecy, if you want to call it that, has come true. What a sad thing. And it just drives home the point that we can't cure society's ills without addressing the failings of the family, which is the microcosm for everything in society. If we fix the family, other things, better things, will come. I like what Leo Tolstoy said once. He said, "Good families are good for the same reasons." With apologies to Mr. Tolstoy, I want to change that just a little bit. I'm going to say godly families are good for the same reasons. So what are those reasons? What are those things that will help us to see God's power for the family? So that others will look at our families and say, you know what? That family is different. What are those things? Well, if you've got an outline this morning in the bulletin, you'll see that we've got some ground to cover this morning, and it's okay. We'll go quickly through those things. But the first thing I want us to notice is that one of the most amazing powers that God has given to us is our own will. And that comes through in the power of commitment. Jesus said about those two who married that they are no longer two but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. No one can come between you, husband and wife, except you yourself. And so that takes commitment. Do you expect from your spouse a lifetime commitment? Before Cheryl and I became Christians, we married when we were young, and of course we had a worldly view of things back then. And even though I loved her and I wanted to marry her, and I surely thought that we would last a long time, in the back of my mind I was thinking, well, if it doesn't work out, we can always get divorced, right? Because that's what you saw everyone doing. Now again, to my shame, that certainly wasn't a biblical view. But it was a view that I had seen that just pervaded society around me. Knowing that that other person is going to be there, the person who's there all the time, is going to stick with you through everything, is a great basis of comfort. It's a basis of confidence. To know that someone keeps their word. There's a Psalm 15 and verse 4, that says this. There's a man who dwells in the tent of the Lord. And this is the man, it says, who swears to his own hurt and does not change. And you know as well as I do that sometimes marriage hurts. Sometimes there is cause for concern, and sometimes there is reason to feel like you want to chuck the whole thing. But when you make a promise, and if you're married, you made that promise, whether it was in a church house setting or before a judge, you made a vow to the other person that I will be with you in sickness and in health, through good times and bad, for richer or for poorer. You might as well just said, you and me, baby, this is what it's about, just you and me. Remembering that promise is going to help us to realize that loyalty is the ability to keep a commitment after the emotion in which the promise is made has passed. Most of us make promises in the heat of some kind of feeling and emotion, don't we? I remember coming home with a puppy when I was a kid. And I told my mom, please, can I keep him? I'll feed him, I'll walk him every day, I'll clean up his mess, please, please, please. A week later, what happened to those promises? You can guess, right? And sometimes people rush into marriage not realizing the promise that they're making to that other person. I want to let our young people know. We've got some young people who are going to be thinking about relationships with those of the opposite gender soon. I want them to realize this. The best way to gauge how well a prospective spouse is going to keep their higher commitment to you is how they keep their commitment to the Lord. If you can find someone who is keeping their commitment to God, you know that that person understands what commitment is all about. God has granted to us the power of commitment. Think about for a moment, though, the power of appreciation. If you're still in Psalm 128, make a left, maybe a page or so. Maybe you don't even have to turn the page. Psalm 127, beginning in verse 3, says, behold, children are a gift from Yahweh. The fruit of the womb, the fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is a man whose quiver is full of them. They'll not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. One of the things that this psalm reminds us of is how God places the responsibility for aiming a kid smack in the parents' hands, right? He speaks of them as arrows. And then he says, for the man who understands that, you can know that you won't be ashamed when you speak in the gate, when your enemies speak in the gate. Why? Because they won't have an accusation of any kind of wrongness or badness to hang on you in respect to your family. Because you've aimed them right. Look with me in Proverbs 31. Make a right with me to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 31. In Proverbs 31, beginning in verse 26, the proverb writer says concerning the godly woman, the virtuous woman. Look what it says concerning how she thinks of those closest to her. In verse 26, it says, "She opens her mouth in wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and bless her. Her husband also, when he praises her, saying, 'Many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all.'" Now, notice what's going on in this wonderful scene. We have a woman who obviously thinks of her family, and she shows them her appreciation of them in real and tangible ways. She looks to their care, and she shows them her concern. And because of that, her family looks to her. Her children rise up later on, it tells us, and call her blessed. Her husband, too, he praises her. And he says, "You know what, out of everybody, you're the one for me. You're the one who has done us well." How important it is for you and I to show respect and love to someone. Isn't that just a common sense way of nurturing and building a relationship? Sometimes in a family, we take those relationships for granted, don't we? Because these people are always there, right? If it's a spouse, you just figure, well, they're not going anywhere. But how often do we need to hear words that say, "I appreciate you"? It could be a simple thank you for taking out the garbage. It could be a passing, "I love you," as you pass one another in the hallway. It can be little ways that show that you want to appreciate more than criticize. And I want to say to our husbands especially, to consider your wives, your partners, your companions, as Genesis 1 or Genesis 2 reminds us, they are a help meet for your life. In Ecclesiastes 9, this is one of my favorite verses in all of Ecclesiastes, because it reminds me of the gift that God has given to me in my wife. Ecclesiastes 9, look with me in verse 9. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 9. "Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given you under the sun. For this is your reward in life and in your toil in which you have labored under the sun." Now, there's a couple of ways that we can take what he calls the reward in that passage. One of those ways is to consider the fact that the reward of our labor, that which we have brought from the fruit of our hands, is the reward. But I prefer to think of it that the reward in life is the person that God has given to me to go through that toil and labor with. He says, "Enjoy life with the woman you love all the days of your fleeting life." And then he says, "For this is God's gift." So when my wife acts like she's God's gift to me, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to say, "You're right. You are." But it should go the other way as well. We need to help to instill a sense of pride and personal self-worth in those relationships that are supposed to be the most important to us. And we need to do it now, before it's too late. Before those whom we love are gone, either moved away or gone from this life for good. And that's why this next power is so important, the power of communication. Good communication is key. Look with me in Colossians chapter 4. You know these verses well, I'm sure. In Colossians chapter 4, the inspired writer, Paul, tells us about the kind of communication that should be coming from our lips. In Colossians chapter 4, in verse 6, Paul says, "Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person." I want to tell you, I take that personally. If some of you see my Facebook posts, you know that I like sarcasm. But sometimes sarcasm says something very unfunny about the one saying it, doesn't it? And so I try to temper that as much as I can with things that are really silly. And if you've seen those Facebook posts, you know what they're all about. How important is it for us To be able to speak words of edification and comfort and help and building up to those whom we love most in this world. In Ephesians chapter 4, go there with me. It's a companion passage to what we just read in Colossians 4. But in Ephesians 4 and in verse 29, Paul the Apostle, the same apostle who wrote Colossians, says, "Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear." Now, I understand that the context is all about making sure that the way you present the gospel is of paramount importance, so that those who you present it to are going to get the full meaning of it and be able to turn themselves to the Lord. But how much more needful is that for us who recognize the need to give grace and seasoning to those who are closest to us, those who we spend so much time with? Do you talk to your plants? Remember a while back, there was a big thing about people talking to their plants. Why? Because it was a proven thing, apparently, that people who spoke to their plants helped those plants to thrive. We used to have a plant years ago. I've got two brown thumbs, okay? I'm not good with plants. But when Cheryl and I first married, we had kind of a vine kind of a plant. I don't know what kind it was. And we even named him. We named him Bosley. Don't ask me why I remember that. That was 100 years ago. But we put Bosley in a prominent corner in our apartment, and we talked to Bosley, or at least I did. And I'd ask him, "Are you thirsty? Do you want a drink of water?" And pretty soon this vine started to grow. And it grew as long as three wall lengths in that apartment living room. And don't tell me talking to plants doesn't work. I don't know what it does, but how much more would talking to those whom we love help them to grow and to thrive? We've already mentioned the importance of compliments, and we need to separate compliment from flattery. They're two different things. We just need to let others know that we love them and that we want to help them. We need to have conversations that matter. Look with me in Matthew chapter 12 for a second. Matthew chapter 12. In Matthew 12, look what Jesus says in verse 36. Matthew 12, verse 36. The Lord said, "I tell you that every careless word that people speak, they shall give an accounting for it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned." Now, generally, we apply this to things of religious value. And that's important. We can and we should. But again, how much or how equally important is it to those conversations that we have with those whom we love? Far too often our conversations with our loved ones are cliche or merely informative in nature. You know, maybe husband comes home from a day at work and wife says, "How was your day?" And he says, "Oh, fine." "Oh, good." That's pretty much the end of that conversation, right? Or maybe we'll go a little deeper and we'll say, "Oh, it looks like there's another storm in the Gulf," or "It looks like rain today." Okay, good information to know. I would suggest that we go deeper with our conversations, to talk about ideas and judgments, to talk about personal feelings, to have conversations that matter, conversations that open ourselves up with one another. And I want to tell you that good conversation is two-sided. Cheryl and I don't always agree on the things that we discuss. And I've come to know that there are three important words. And I need to know when to say those words. "You're right, dear." But we can talk to one another about those things, even when we disagree. And the important thing is to be able to talk about those things that matter. Look with me for a moment in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Go all the way back to the Old Testament. Deuteronomy chapter 6. In Deuteronomy 6, Moses is telling the people about how important it is that they raise their children to know what God requires of them. In Deuteronomy 6 and in verse 7, Moses said, "You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up." So Moses says, anytime is a good time to talk about what God wants from you. Teach your children these things and take every opportunity to do that. In verse 20, he says, "When your son asks you in time to come, saying, 'What do the testimonies and the statutes and the judgments mean which the Lord our God commanded you?' Then you shall say to your son, 'We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and Yahweh brought us from Egypt with a mighty hand.'" He says, at some point, your children are going to notice how important these things are to you. And they're going to ask you, why? What's the big deal? And then you can get to tell them about what a personal way God has dealt with you. Man. But did you notice? The children are asking why. Do we have that kind of environment in our home where our children are inquisitive about the lifestyle of mom and dad, and they ask them about that? Did you know that, well, maybe you didn't know this, but here's another interesting statistic that I ran across recently. A TV report that I saw said that parents only spend an average of 3 minutes a day talking to their kids. 3 minutes a day! If you want closer relationships with your children, with your spouse, talk to them. And of course, that necessitates the power of spending time together, real time. Look with me in Ephesians chapter 5. In Ephesians 5, Paul the Apostle says in verse 15, "Be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time, because the days are evil." Now, it doesn't matter what era we apply these evil days to, they're true all the time, right? Because there is one who is the God of this world that is working overtime to make sure that those who want to submit themselves to the God of the universe don't do so. And so we need to consider how it is we're going to spend our time, he says, because those days are evil. We need to make the time, especially with those whom we love, count. There's a proverb I love. It's Proverbs 29, verse 15. I like how the New King James Version puts it. Proverbs 29, 15 from the New King James says this: "A child left to himself brings shame to his mother." A child left to himself brings shame to his mother. It's a reminder of a couple of different things. One, that children need guidance from someone older, someone who's able to give them guidance. And two, the need to spend time with that one to give them that guidance. You want to know how children spell love? T-I-M-E. There was a song some time ago. And if you're 100 years old like I am, you might remember it. It's called "Cat's Cradle" by Harry Chapin. Anybody remember that? It's a story about a little kid who was growing up and wanted to spend time with his dad, wanted to play catch with him and all this stuff. And the dad kept telling him, "I don't have time for that. I don't have time for that now." And then the father grew up and retired and suddenly had time on his hands, but his son had grown up and moved away. So he calls his son and says, "Hey son, I'd like to spend some time with you." And the son says, "Gee, I'd really like to, but if I could just find the time. But I've got a new job and my kids are sick, and I'll catch up with you another time. Been good talking to you, Dad. Goodbye." And there's a line in that song that to me is just incredibly sad. He sings, "As I hung up the phone, it occurred to me, he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me." Sometimes our biggest mistake is not something we do, but what we fail to do. C.S. Lewis once said, "No time spent with a child is wasted time." And sometimes that's exactly how we think of it, right? We've got to learn to plan, to schedule, to make time for our families with one another. And never, never, never choose your career, your friends, over your family. That means we're going to have to understand the power of a strong value system. I'm convinced that Timothy, as young as he was, knew what this was all about. In 2 Timothy chapter 1, go there with me. 2 Timothy chapter 1. In 2 Timothy 1, Paul writes to his young protege, and he tells him in verse 5, I'm mindful of the sincere faith within you, which first dwelt in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I am sure that is in you as well. Now make a right with me to chapter 3 of the same letter, 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy 3. In verse 14, Paul says, you, however, continue in the things you have learned and become convinced of, knowing from whom you've learned them, and that from childhood you have known the sacred writings which are able to give you the wisdom that leads to salvation through faith, which is in Christ Jesus. Now in chapter 3, Paul tells Timothy, don't forget the stuff you learned from childhood. Well, who taught him that stuff? Well, Grandma Lois and Mama Eunice, right? 2 Timothy 1 and verse 5. I am convinced that Mom and Grandma took young Timothy to Sabbath day synagogue services where he heard the law of God expounded upon by the scholars of that day. And when he got home, Mom and Grandma had the opportunity to tell young Timothy what those things meant to them as Israelites, what those things meant to them as people of God, what those things meant to them and how they could be imported into practical living in their lives, how it set them apart from everybody else. Ephesians 6 verse 4, you know what that says. Fathers are supposed to bring their children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. As parents, we have a huge responsibility to make sure that we have a value system in our families and that value system needs to be clearly defined to everybody that's in the house. So that means we need to spend time talking about those things. When my children were young, we used to do, and to my shame, I'll say that, we didn't do it as regularly as I wish we could have or should have, but we tried to spend regular, that's a relative term, time with our children in biblical learning, away from the assemblies, away from church Bible classes. For a while, we were doing weekly devotionals with our family, and I made fun little pages for our kids to fill in with biblical word finds and stuff like that. But we would find a passage, we would talk about it, we'd sing some songs, and then we'd find key words in those word finds. How important is it for us to make sure that there is a way in this family that we uphold above everything? Every family has their traditions, right? And we hold to those traditions. I've got mine and my family, and you've got yours and yours. But one of the most important things that we want to make sure that continue through generation after generation after generation, it's those things that are godly, that point each of our succeeding generations to God. Strong families are aware of those strong value systems and that they are, in essence, an example to everyone else around them. You know what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5 and verse 16? Let your light shine in such a way so that others will see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. If we're going to apply that to the family, I want our families to recognize that when you go through your day, when your children go through their day at school and you go through your day at work or wherever you might happen to be, and others know that you are a Christian, they're going to expect something of you. And when they see the decisions that you make, in spite of the peer pressure to make other kinds of decisions, and they see that you stick to that system of values that are biblical in nature, they're going to know that God is the one who directs that decision. They're going to know that God is the one who helps you make that choice. Strong families are aware of the importance of instituting a good value system and maintaining it. Another interesting statistic. I'm full of them this morning, aren't I? Nearly 20% of couples become more ethically or morally conservative after having children. It certainly happened for Cheryl and I. After we started having kids, we realized that, wow, okay, now we got to raise these kids. What are we going to do about that? How are we going to do it in such a way so that they grow up to be positive and contributing members of society? We didn't want our kids to be a drain on society. We wanted them to contribute positively, socially. I like that statistic. You know, in Genesis chapter 5, we're not going to turn there, but in Genesis chapter 5, there's that chapter that we kind of go through really fast. It tells us about so-and-so who became the father of so-and-so and lived for 900 years and then he died. And then that son became the father of someone else and then he lived for 700 years and then he died, right? It goes on and on and on like that. And then we get to Enoch. Enoch has the distinction of being one of two men in the Bible who didn't die. It tells us that Enoch walked with God and then he was not, for God took him. But do you know that before Enoch walked with God, it tells us in Genesis 5 that he became the father of a kid named Methuselah. How'd you like to name your kid Methuselah? He became the father of Methuselah. And then it tells us that he walked with God after he became his son's father. Well, I don't know if that's got the same connotation that I'm putting to it today, but it certainly fits. When we recognize that responsibility, we hopefully grasp the obligation to raise them right. And certainly that would include the power to discipline. We've been going through 1 Samuel in our adult Bible class. And one of the things that we first notice in 1 Samuel is the wickedness of Eli, who was the priest at Shiloh at that time. The wickedness of his sons. And when God brings judgment on that family, he says specifically in 1 Samuel 3:13 that it's because of the wickedness of Eli's sons and how Eli did not restrain them. Look with me at Proverbs 19 for a moment. Proverbs 19. In Proverbs 19, we're going to look together at verse 18. Proverbs 19 and verse 18. Scripture says, discipline your son while there is hope, and do not desire his death. Okay, what does that mean? Well, it reminds us, first of all, about what the aim of discipline is. Discipline literally means teaching. It means to instruct. And so that tells us that discipline is more instructive than it is punitive. Yes, we want to make sure that our kids don't do that bad thing ever again. We want them to know that there are going to be consequences to it when they do, but we want them to learn the lesson of that. Your parents ever tell you, I'm going to teach you a lesson? That's exactly what they were doing. They wanted you to know wrong from right. In Proverbs 13, go there with me, make a left to Proverbs 13, and look with me in verse 24. Proverbs 13, verse 24. Says, he who withholds his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him diligently. Now, this is not a lesson on spanking or corporal punishment or anything like that. But it is a reminder to us that we need to let our children know that there are consequences to doing wrong. And whatever the consequences in your household might be, they need to be severe enough so that the child will know, I can't afford to do this anymore. It goes against this value system that my parents want me to learn. It's not about spanking. It's about teaching. It's about teaching them to respect God, family, themselves. We need to understand what discipline is for. And here's a bonus point for you. You've come to the end of it in your outline, but as I was thinking about it, I thought, you know, all of this helps us in a way that we need right now. All of these things help us to have the power to cope with crisis. In Ecclesiastes chapter 4, go there with me. Ecclesiastes 4. In Ecclesiastes 4, begin with me, if you will, in verse 9. Says, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. But if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone. And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. Can I suggest that we make an application to this, to the family? Strong families rely on the resources of one another to stay strong, to maintain their sense of ethics and morality in the midst of moral turmoil. I think of Noah, who lost everything. Noah lost his home. He lost his friends. But he saved his family. And I'm convinced that for the year that they were on that boat, that they clung not only to God, but to one another for strength and for hope. Runaway children are increasing more and more every year. But you know what else is increasing? Runaway mothers and fathers. Everybody abandoning their relationship, abandoning their responsibility, abandoning their obligations, not only to God, but to one another. Why? Mostly, I guess, it's because they feel that there's no solution to their problems at home. Home is not a refuge. Sometimes home is a battleground. And the easiest thing to do is just to leave it. Our homes, I'm going to suggest, ought to be places of refuge. They ought to be a place where dad can come home and know that he's going to find not the stresses of his job there, but those who will comfort him through those stresses. Where our young people will come home and find not the stresses of peer pressure there, but the comfort of mom and dad who love them, and those kids know that mom and dad love them. A place where mom can feel that she's doing her part to contribute to the well-being of her family, just as we saw of that virtuous woman in Proverbs 31. A place where everybody understands their part, knows their role, seizes their responsibility, and knows that everybody in the family is better because of it. Our homes need to be places of refuge. And so our families need to be supportive of one another, loyal to one another, especially in times of trouble. This morning we've looked at a pretty lengthy list of things that God has given us the power to do in His Word. And I hope we can see clearly how they help us this morning. Psalm 128, that idyllic scene of a family gathered together in love and mutual respect with devotion to God, that can be your reality. So what's missing? Well, the application of these things that we talked about this morning. So, mom and dad, what will you do to make Psalm 128 your reality? Young people, what will you do to recognize that you have a place in the family and it's a valued place, and that you can contribute to the wellness of that family just as much as mom and dad can? We sing a song sometimes, and I wish I would have called Joe and asked him to lead it for us. God, give us Christian homes. How much do we need those homes today? It begins with Christ. And if you're not a Christian, you can begin your Christian home by giving yourself first to the Lord. We're going to stand in a moment and sing a song. The intention of that song is to get you to do just that, to consider where you stand before God, and to submit yourself to Him and to His Son in immersion in water for the forgiveness of your sins. And if you've done that, and you've come to the realization that my home is not what it needs to be, and partly it's because of me, partly it's my fault, then just make your resolution to yourself and to your God this morning, where you sit or where you stand, that when you leave this place today, things are going to start being different. But if you need the prayers of your brethren, we want to help you. Can we? Come now, please, while we stand and sing.